Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome to a very special edition of Hell in a Cell Talk Radio. I am your host, Dean Dixon. With me, as always, is Dan Colachico.
You.
And Mark Thompson is with us as well. Tonight, very special episode, as I said. We have author David D. Cook. He is the author. He has written over 500 articles about the Centralia mine fire. He has written a book about Centralia. It was revised again under a new title, Fire Underground, The Ongoing Tragedy of the Centralia Mine Fire. And right now I'm going to bring on David. Hello, David. You are on the line with us. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Great. And hello to everybody out there who may or may not know me out there in the internet land.
I wanted to start out the first question, because when I read your book, you started out with John Condington when he passed out, but then the second chapter was the murder of Jane Benfield and how that was the innocence that was lost for Centralia. Can you go a little bit into that?
Well, that took place in 1961, and she was a 13-year-old girl in Centralia, just a very typical young, innocent 13-year-old girl. And one day, this sex criminal by the name of Frank Earl Sink came to Centralia. His job, he was a magazine salesman, and he traveled from town to town and went house to house selling subscriptions to magazines. But he was also, he was a sex criminal. And he saw Jane, who was out delivering some jars of jelly to a sick neighbor, and he stopped and talked to her, and he was smooth and talked her into getting into his car and asked her to show him, you know, where the Centralia kids went to go swimming. And
oh,
so she guided him through the town, and people saw them, actually. She waved to people on the street, you know, and it was a different time then. And he took her out into the strip mining areas outside of Centralia and raped and killed her.
And that was pretty much when the innocence was lost for Centralia.
It really was. I mean, certainly it was not a perfect little town, but it was pretty good, and people just didn't expect anything like that to happen. You know, it was really the outside world, coming into their little world, and with horrible results.
The next thing in your book that you go into is May 7th, 1962. That is the council meeting that set the fire into motion, pretty much. Now, what happened that day, May 7th, 1962, at that council meeting?
They authorized a cleanup project at the town landfill. And that doesn't sound, too out of the ordinary. Memorial Day was coming up, and they wanted the dump, which happened to be next to the Oddfellows Cemetery in Centralia, the Protestant cemetery. They wanted to have it cleaned up, so when people came out to the cemetery on Memorial Day, which at that time was still the original Memorial Day on May 30th, I believe it was, and so they wanted it to at least look a little bit better, not quite smell so bad. And what they did was they hired five members of the Centralia Fire Company to go out and set the dump on fire. And they had done this many times before, but the problem was, the difference was this year, was that the landfill had been moved to a different location. It had previously been behind the Catholic cemetery, St. Ignatius Cemetery, and it didn't meet new state requirements for landfills, and so the state dump inspector had told them to, you know, find a different location. And so there was this old strip mining pit from the 1930s near the Oddfellows Cemetery, and it was easily accessible by, you know, by road, you know, dirt road, and it was, there was a lot of space in it. It was a pretty big pit, and so they decided they would make that into their landfill. And the thing about old strip mine pits in Pennsylvania is that they often cut through old deep mines. Because, you know, there's a lot of coal down there after the deep mines go through, and so the strip miners would just come in and dig these big pits and get what was left, you know, out of there, and sometimes they would, you know, break through into, you know, what had been underground mines. And and this was fairly well known in Centralia. In fact, the state inspector had told them to that they had to close up some of these holes before they could use it as a dump.
It was still authorized in that May 7th meeting to have the controlled burn.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
So your theory, and what you research very thoroughly in your book, and you interviewed people, you named people.
Mm-hmm.
Joan Quigley, in her 2007 book, mm-hmm. The Day the Earth Caved In, she has a different theory where she says that hot ash was dumped into the landfill, and that's what caused the fire. Could you go into the differences and why you believe your theory is the correct one?
Well, under her theory, she believes that the fire started a day before it actually did. And my basic problem with her theory is that she doesn't really name sources other than one woman, Mary Lou Gaughan. And she talks about having interviewed all these people who told her that hot ashes were dumped, you know, by a trash hauler by the name of Curly Stasilevich. And she doesn't name anybody who actually told her that. And there's no indication in her book that she ever interviewed or attempted to interview, you know, Curly Stasilevich or members of his family if he was still alive. And it's, you heard a lot of stories about how the fire started, you know, back in the you know, the late 1970s, early 1980s, you know, when the fire was nearly 20 years old at that point. And, you know, and you would hear that it started by spontaneous combustion. You would hear that it was an old mine fire that came up through, you know, the workings and started the dump on fire, which incidentally was physically impossible because there were active underground mines in that area. And those miners would have been asphyxiated if there had been a mine fire in the immediate area.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason I believe, you know, my theory is correct is because I went through all the available documents. I looked at what they said, you know, in the borough council minutes, in other documents, and then I interviewed as many people as I could who had been there at the time, and what they said, you know, especially a former borough council member by the name of Francis Gonzalez, you know, they said this was the practice. They would go out, you know, before Memorial Day, you know, or before Easter, whatever, you know, holiday happened to be coming up, and they would set the dumps on fire. Mm-hmm. You know, and then I actually tracked down and interviewed the five firemen. One of them may have been passed on at that point, but I talked to the other four. You know, some denied even being there, even though they were listed in the borough council minutes as having been paid for putting out the fire that day. And they grudgingly conceded that, at least one or two of them did, that yes, they had set a fire in the dump that day, but they sure didn't believe it could have become, you know, the mine fire. Well, you know, when you have a fire being set, you know, and dump fires being notoriously hard to put out, it just doesn't, I mean, there just isn't any other real theory that I can accept as to, you know, how that fire started. And, you know, again, I go back to the fact that, you know, yes, hot ashes sometimes did get dumped into landfills in Pennsylvania, but there just isn't any evidence that Joan Quigley is willing to share, other than these kind of broad statements, you know, that this was actually how the fire started.
Being that the general consensus is that the fire department pretty much was the fuel to this terrible fire, were any of the firefighters involved, the volunteers, I believe, were they ever held responsible, more or less, for this incident?
No, they never were. Basically, this was kind of forgotten right away. I mean, you look through the documents, you know, the letters they sent to the state, you know, in succeeding, you know, weeks when they were trying to get help with this fire, and you see, and there's no attribution to, you know, this controlled burn. In fact, you know, they blamed hot weather in one, you know, letter to the state. They said hot weather had started the dump on fire. And, you know, I don't really, I mean, I'm not trying to, you know, come down, you know, hard on them. You know, they were human beings, you know, in a real fix. And they were trying to do the best they could. But facts are facts, and it's best that people know how this really happened. You know, and I will say, too, that, you know, that after my book came out, you know, nobody ever came up to me and said, well, you're wrong, it was hot ashes. In fact, it was just the opposite. They said, well, you know, we knew this all the time, and you know, I'm glad you wrote about it.
After the fire started, there were efforts to put it out. But through the 60s, it just seemed that there were a lot of missed opportunities, and you actually had a chapter in your book named that. It could have been put out, I believe, the former mayor has been on record saying that they could have put it out for $1,000 within weeks of it starting. But there were, throughout the 60s, just a lot of opportunities. Can you just go into some of those missed opportunities for us?
Yeah, well, right from the very start, you had a guy by the name of Clarence Cashner, who went by Mooch. His nickname was Mooch. And he was the head of the Independent, you know, Miners Association. And they, you know, they were the guys who were, they were not union mines, but they were basically these one- and two-man operations, you know. And anyway, when the fire started there, he offered to bring somebody in, you know, one of his people to, you know, to come in. And they said, well, we'll put the fire out for $175 as long as we can keep whatever coal we recover. Well, no, they didn't want to do that. And it became a bureaucratic nightmare, really. I mean, it took the entire summer of 1962 before anything was done, you know, in Centralia. And the price just kept going up every time. You know, where the first project had failed, I think, was about, you know, a $20,000 project, while the next one was, you know, a little bit more than that, and the one after that was a little bit more. And the main problem was that they never had enough money to do the job right. They would start the project, you know, and they'd be going good, and then they would run out of money, and they would just stop work. Or they would stop work on things like Labor Day weekend in 1962. That's one of the famous stories about how they just put down their tools because it was, you know, a holiday. And the fire didn't take a holiday. The fire kept on burning for the weekend, and so it was even further along, you know, by the time they came back.
They had plenty chances to solve the problem, and then they almost waffled back and started pushing out of the people in the town. Why do you think there was such indecision with whether to solve the problem or whether to evacuate everyone?
Well, it was by the time that really got serious, which was, you know, in about 1980, you know, there were people who had gas alarms going off in their house on a daily basis. And, you know, you had, you know, Todd Dombrowski falling into the subsidence and barely surviving. There were people, you know, in the what we call the mine fire impact area that were really in a bad way. You know, their kids were sick from the fumes coming into the house. Especially kids with asthma. You know, they would, or other chronic respiratory conditions, they were really affected by that carbon monoxide, you know, and the funny stuff in the air that was coming in through the basement, you know, from the mine fire down below. You know, it was just a terrible situation for them to be living in. And but on the other hand, you had people who lived on the other side of town that was not yet affected by the fire, who some of them were more concerned about preserving the town than in helping some of the people who had real problems. Now that wasn't entirely. I mean, there were some people who lived right in the impact zone, like the Womers, who were very much against a mass relocation. You know, they thought that there was something that could be done to stop the fire, but it just didn't happen. And so you got the town divided basically into two main factions. You know, you had the people who really wanted to get the heck out of there because they were scared for their lives, for the kids' lives. And you had people who, you know, had kind of this brigadoonish image of Centralia, you know, and they couldn't let go of that. You know, they, even though, you know, you had these problems, you know, with these terrible environmental problems, you still had people that, you know, and this is very understandable. I mean, all they could think of was, you know, what a great town they had grown up in, you know, that their parents had grown up in, and they didn't want to see it torn down.
In the documentary, it's mentioned very quickly that, you know, it was because money was an issue. I don't understand why, and maybe you can enlighten a little bit, why, even if money was a question, why they did not act faster to just stop it. I mean, this is, quite frankly, a serious situation. They just, we have the money for it.
Well, part of the problem, I actually think it was a big part of the problem, was that Centralia didn't have good representation at the state and federal level early on. It was the weird way that the town was districted. You know, they were really the only coal mining area in each of the districts that they were in, you know, whether it be, you know, Columbia County or, you know, their congressional district, their state senatorial district. You know, there would be a whole lot of agriculture, light manufacturing, small town stuff, that kind of thing. And then you had this coal mining area. And so naturally, you know, the people that represented those districts were just not really attuned very much to the danger of what was happening in Centralia. It really wasn't until Congressman Daniel Flood from Wilkes-Barre became Centralia's congressman after the court-ordered redistricting in about 1964, I think it was. And then Centralia actually had a congressman who knew the score, you know, who was very good at getting federal money, and he did so. But by that time, the fire had gotten so big that they just didn't. I mean, yeah, they appropriated a lot of money, but they couldn't really do the job the way that they really wanted to do. They had to put in this underground fly ash barrier instead of digging it out of the ground.
Throughout that time, from the late 1960s until November 1st, 1976, there wasn't much coverage about the Centralia Mine Fire until a young reporter on his first job got the assignment to go to the Centralia Council meeting on November 1st, 1976. And during that time, I believe it was Tony Gahn who stood up and started talking about the fire. You perked up and you said, "I have a story here." And that's when the coverage started. Now, what was that like for you? You knew you had a story and you wanted to tell it to people because this was something that you felt it needed to be told. So what was that like for you as a young reporter getting this story that no one else was even talking about at the time?
Well, it was exciting. You know, it was, I think a lot of us in that generation of reporters, the ones that came out after, you know, graduated from college after Watergate, were very eager to find stories where we could, you know, help people with our reporting. You know, and this seemed like a classic situation for that. You know, and thankfully, the editor of the Shamokin News item where I worked, a guy by the name of Tom Brennan, who I believe is still alive, was very supportive of, you know, my reporting. And he basically let me do as much reporting as I wanted, you know, and that number 500 stories, that actually was true. I mean, I counted them one day, and I was amazed myself, you know. Of course, this is over a 10-year period, but you know, they were, the Shamokin News item was very supportive, and so whenever there was a story to be written in Centralia, you know, they let me write it.
After this, the story of the fire and the residents and the trouble they were in started picking up steam, no pun intended, was there any, not government-wise, but like from any surrounding towns, or not even surrounding towns, any towns anywhere that was lending their hand out for support, trying to help these people, help the situation at all?
Other towns. Well, it wasn't so much towns. It was basically it was progressive social organizations, really. You know, like, you know, Catholic Charities, or a woman by the name of you know, Marie Cirillo down in Tennessee, who had done a lot of work in Appalachia. You know, with people dealing with coal mining issues. It's her area is there's many differences between there and Centralia, but she came up and she was very helpful. I mean, she got the people to organize, you know, and she helped the Concerned Citizens, you know, group in Centralia to, you know, travel to Harrisburg, travel to Washington, D.C., you know, to meet with, you know, U.S. Senator, you know, Arlen Specter. They actually also met with Al D'Amato. I never quite figured out how that happened, but, you know, he was very nice to them and urged them to, you know, keep on fighting, but you know, anyway, you had these outsiders who came in. There was also the Spiegel and McDermott law firm from Washington D.C. that did a lot of pro bono work, you know, with you know, people in coal mining areas. You know, they spent time up in Centralia. So it was a lot of help like that kind of got the citizens group pointed in the right direction.
February 14th, 1981, that is when the subsidence came. Todd Dombrowski fell through the ground, almost passed away because of that. But that day, there were also people from the government there trying to help out, or at least looking at the town. What was going on that day?
Yeah, that was a truly amazing coincidence. It was on February 14, 1981, Valentine's Day. And Centralia had a new congressman. Dan Flood had, you know, retired in, I think it was 1978, you know, because of health reasons and increasing legal problems that he was having. And he was temporarily replaced by Senator Ray Musto, who became congressman for about 9 months. And then when the next election came along, Musto was defeated by James Nelligan. This was in 1980. Nelligan came in the Reagan sweep in 1980, and he was basically a pretty good guy. A little bit you know, caustic at times, but he wanted to do the right thing, and he decided he was going to, you know, organize a meeting in Centralia of all the, you know, the key people that knew anything about this problem. You know, and of course, in the beginning of 1981, the problem was getting really bad there with the gases, and so, you know, Nelligan was there. You know, Centralia's state senator Ed Helfrich was there. I believe state representative Bob Belfonte, and a number of people from you know, the state and federal mining, you know, agencies. And so they're across the street at Connington's gas station, you know, just on their basic tour of Centralia, and Todd Dombrowski's grandmother, Carrie Wolfgang, you know, is looking out her front window, and she sees these guys in suits, you know, there, and she calls her daughter, you know, Florence Dombrowski, and says, you know, there's something going on over there. I don't know who it is. And so they decided between them that they would send Todd over to find out, you know, who these guys were. And so Todd takes off on a run, and he cuts through the, you know, the side yards across the street from his home. And you know, when he gets to his grandmother's backyard in that general area, he stops and he sees his cousin Eric Wolfgang, who was a couple years older than him. Eric was about 14, I believe. And Eric was working on a motorcycle. You know, and then Todd, you know, continued on his way. Well, he didn't get very far, and he sees this little wisp of steam, or what he thought was smoke, actually, you know, coming up from the ground. And he goes over to investigate, and he drops out of sight. beneath the ground. It was a subsidence caused by the mine fire. He saved himself by holding on to tree roots, which you can actually see the roots in some of the photos that were taken that day. He's yelling for help, and by now that little wisp of steam has become a huge plume of steam. Now the pole is big, and you know he's yelling for help, but his cousin hears this, and he's looking around. He can hear Todd, but he can't see him because of the steam. And he goes over, toward the voice and where he hears, the voice coming from, and he sees the hole, and he kind of basically assumes that Todd is down the hole, and he's looking around, and he finally sees Todd's orange hunting cap, and he reaches down and grabs him by the jacket and just yanks him out of the hole, and so Todd was covered with mud, but he was alive, and it was a very touchy situation. The hole was something like 175 feet deep. They later determined, the gases were deadly. And if he had been in there much longer, it would have been a real tragedy.
A month later, the John Coddington incident happens where he's overcome by carbon monoxide. And this is really when, I think, with the Todd Dombrowski incident and then John Coddington almost passing away as well, this is when the government finally said, we really have to do something. Am I correct in that assessment, or is this when things...
That is correct, and another important factor was that the worldwide media latched onto this story. It wasn't just, Dave DeCook at the Shimoka News item anymore. It was, the Village Voice, Globo TV from Brazil. I ran into a crew of theirs one day in Centralia. People from literally all over the map were coming there because the story was so strange, and that kept the pressure on government, and never really let up after that. But you're right that government, Governor Dick Thornburg, and ultimately Secretary of the Interior James Watt in Washington realized that something had to be done, but then, it became another battle as to who was going to actually pay the bill for this. Watt didn't want to pay for it, and Thornburg didn't want to pay for it. The money was there. They had this thing called the Abandoned Mineland Fund, which had been created, in 1977 after Congress, at the urging of President Jimmy Carter, passed the Abandoned Mine, Surface Mining Control and Reclamation Act, that's what it was called. And basically it was to clean up all these, the century of abandoned mine land problems, strip mine pits, old mines, that kind of thing, that, were all across the country, but particularly in the coal mining areas of the country. So they, then Thornburg actually came to Centralia on March 31st of 1981, for kind of a look-see tour. You have that picture of me on your website there, talking to Thornburg. I looked much younger and thinner at that point, but and so it was just a fascinating political event that day. I mean, Thornburg was cagey, but once he was there, he had to have seen how bad it was. And in fact, the documentary record after that shows that, things started to happen then. It didn't happen as quickly as it ought to have, but at least it started to happen. They moved some of the first people out but there was still, go back to that, dispute within the town of Centralia, there were still people who were fighting the relocation who didn't think there was any necessity for it, so some of the most bitter days were yet to come.
Thornburg, I'm not sure if it was during his first visit there in 1981 or later on, he actually said no one would be forced out. He was against eminent domain, but something happened along the lines. Was it after Thornburg was out?
Well, Thornburg did say that, and they really they took that to heart. When they administered the relocation, nobody had to leave, and it was actually carried almost to an extreme. Sometimes, you would have, these old, row houses, and you would have one neighbor that was going to leave, and the other, and the adjoining neighbor who wasn't. And so the practice was when somebody agreed to relocate, you know, took the money, they would tear down their house. But if they knew that with some of these old houses, that if they tore down the house next to it, that the other house might fall down because the old house, the other house that was torn down had kind of been holding it up. So what they did was they built these brick buttresses on the side of the house that was staying. And supposedly the cost per house was in the neighborhood of like $100,000, and they maybe did a dozen of these. It was an amazing sight to see. And ironically, I think there's only one of those houses left. And the rest have all been torn down because the people that lived in them eventually, you know, well, some died, you know, but most of them eventually just decided that, yeah, we don't want to live here anymore. And so they were still allowed to relocate, and, you know, the house was torn down. But as far as Governor Casey, you have to kind of fast forward to, I think it was 1991 or 92 when this happened. And the Columbia County Redevelopment Authority was not a big fan of keeping the relocation, you know, going for the, you know, the couple of dozen people who wanted to still, you know, live in Centralia. I mean, the Redevelopment Authority was essentially running the town. I mean, yes, there was a borough council and a mayor, you know, in Centralia, but, you know, the Redevelopment Authority had to mow all these lawns that, you know, where houses used to be, and kind of, you know, take care of things like that. And Bill Klink, you know, eventually, who did a great job on this, by the way, but he eventually got tired of this, and he finally, you know, found a willing ear in Harrisburg, and they agreed. They said, well, this is crazy, you know, let's just invoke eminent domain and move these people out. Well, that set off a firestorm, you know, and they did invoke eminent domain, but it didn't really. The only people that really left because of that were people who thought that they, you know, that the end was inevitable, and so we might as well leave now. But you still have the diehards, you know, fighting to the bitter end. You know, the ones who wanted to stay, who considered, you know, their neighbors to be traitors if they left. You know, it just got to be an odd situation. You know, there you had, you know, the borough council applying for municipal improvement grants, you know, for a town that was being demolished, and so it was just odd. And, you know, and it wasn't really until the Rendell administration that they finally made a move to get the remaining few people, you know, out. You know, Governor Ed Rendell, and this was in the first part of the 2000s, and and they actually got some people to leave, but they in the end they kind of lost their nerve, just like previous governors had, and they weren't willing to throw some of the people out. The younger ones they made leave, the older ones they let stay.
Were there any legal fights that the residents of Centralia put up to try to stay, and was there anything they could stand behind?
Well, they did hire lawyers to fight the eminent domain, but they really did not have a leg to stand on. It was very easy for, you know, the government to prove that there was a hazard, you know, in Centralia, that the previous government had good reason to invoke eminent domain, and so. I really feel they kind of got led down the primrose path by some of the lawyers they hired, you know, and ended up, you know, paying money in legal fees that was really a waste of money. So that's how that happened. And then in the end, the last legal fights, some of which I believe may still be going on, were over the underlying value of the house, you know, to determine how much they would be paid, you know, for the house and how much they would get in relocation assistance.
The question I want to bring up, now, you were talking about the diehards of the diehards. Now, there were three women that were really the diehards of the diehards. You have Helen Womer, Mary Lou Gaughan, and Elaine Jurgel. Were they really, I guess the best word I can come up with is nasty about all this? I mean, they were really against relocation.
They were, and I mean, I hate to, you know, use that adjective, you know, over the air, but I mean, there were people who did not like the way that they, you know, conducted their campaign against relocation. They were advised, the three women were, by a priest by the name of Father Anthony McGinley, who was very much disliked by the people who wanted to relocate. McGinley had been a psychology professor at Catholic University in Washington. He was from Centralia and had retired back there. He was not popular, let's say, among many in the town. In fact, there were complaints to the diocese about him, from what I understand. But in any case, you know, it got bitter there. And it wasn't so much, you know, the three women as it was, you know, members of the borough council who, you know, did not want to relocate, did not want to see the town torn apart, as they put it, you know. And I mean, some of those meetings that were held were just ugly. And, you know, and I doubt if people have truly recovered from some of that today, you know, even.
With knowing all that you know about how it was planned, how they tried to stop the fire, how they tried to relocate people, what do you think the biggest mistake made throughout the whole process really was?
The biggest mistake was not recognizing at the beginning that this was something that, you know, whatever their bureaucratic imperative might have told them, they needed to find money for this. And to make it happen, you know, to stop that fire in its tracks, you know, when it was still small. By the time it got big, you know, it was just all they could do, you know, were these holding actions, like the fly ash barrier, and I would really say that was the biggest mistake, the failure by the state and federal governments to realize that, you know, they just had to find the money somewhere.
Is there any way that you know of that they can turn tragedy into an opportunity and harness the fire for some sort of energy?
Well, there's been any number of people over the years who have proposed just that sort of thing, but none of the ideas have ever come to fruition. You know, I'm not sure whether, you know, the industry would find Centralia Mine Fire to be a good investment because of the uncertainty involved in how long the fire would burn and at what intensity, you know, that sort of thing. Nobody has really ever stepped up, you know, with serious money to try anything like that. It's interesting, within the past 2 weeks, there have been, I've met with or talked on the phone with two people who, you know, are very serious people. You know, they're very, you know, well-meaning and dedicated, and they have techniques that their companies have developed, you know, for putting out underground fires, and they would love to give it a shot in Centralia. I just talked today to a woman down in Texas who works for a company that uses, you know, foam to put out underground fires. And the other guy that I talked to, had lunch with last week, his idea was to use this special type of underground cement that could be pumped down there. But, you know, what it comes down to ultimately is that nobody's going to be willing to spend the kind of money it would take to do that, to put the fire out, even with these more reasonable techniques, you know, because there's only 9 people left living there. And, you know, that was really the trade-off that was made back in 1983. They decided that they weren't going to put the fire out, and they were going to just relocate people. And, you know, maybe 100 years from now, the fire will move close enough to Mount Carmel, the town down the road, that people might decide that, hey, we better stop this thing. But, I mean, that's outside of everybody's lifetime, you know, right now, and it's just not the mojo isn't there to get a big project going to stop the fire.
So once again, just like what started the big problem, it's preventing it is a money issue.
Exactly. Right. Right.
Now, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, this has kind of become, not kind of, it has become one of those cult places where people go and visit to see what happened in Centralia.
That's right.
A, is it dangerous to live there right now? And B, are you in immediate danger if you go to visit?
The answer to A is that there is one man, Mr. Womer, who still lives in the mine fire impact zone. And I believe he has an adult child living with him. I would not live in that house. I would not spend the night in that house. You know, but he's pulled it off for, you know, 50 years now. And so I don't know. You know, I would not, like I said, I would not, you know, spend a night in that house. Now, as far as people visiting Centralia, what I usually say is, you know, use common sense. You know, if you see a steaming hole in the ground, don't walk near it, you know, that kind of thing. But for the most part, it's safe enough, you know, as long as you use common sense. And you're probably more in danger of, you know, you're tripping on some rocks than you are of you know, falling into a, you know, a mine fire subsidence. But you go out there, especially during the summertime, which ironically is the worst time to see, you know, the mine fire steam.
Anything in.
Yeah, and but you go out there on any summer weekend, any summer day, really, and you'll see, you know, people stopping there to walk up to look at the, you know, the steaming areas and things like that. We're down to see the big cracks in the closed portion of the highway. And they come from all over the place. You know, one day when I was there, there a busload or a vanload of high school students from Washington State, you know, stopped by. And then there was this couple from Spain. You know, it's really, you know, they come from everywhere. Some of them are drawn to it because of its association with Silent Hill, you know, the movie, and which the screenwriter Roger Avery of Silent Hill has said publicly that he was, you know, inspired by the Centralia mine fire when he wrote this, and obviously he takes a lot of liberties with the facts. I mean, as far as we know, there are no demons living beneath Centralia, but it makes for a good you know, science fiction horror movie. But you know, there's a lot of fans that come just for that reason, you know, and so I've often wished that I could have like a vending machine for my book, you know, right there, and they could just stick their credit card in, and it comes down clunk, you know, and
cha-ching.
But I don't think that's going to happen. I sometimes give tours, you know, there. I charge for it, but you know, it's for. You know, some of the people who are real fans of my book are you know, they want me to give them a personal tour of where things happened in Centralia. And what I generally do is I bring along, you know, blow-up photos of how things used to look. And, you know, I'll say, you know, okay, you're standing here on what was Coddington's gas station, you know, and if you see that dead tree across the street, well, here's that same tree in this picture, and you can see all of those houses that were there. You know, people seem to be really interested in it, and so you know, I do them every once in a while.
When was the last report, or has there ever been an officially, other than the incidents that you've already mentioned, a reported incident that was directly related to the mine fire?
Can you clarify that? I'm not quite sure what you mean.
The kid falling in the hole. Has anybody ever gone to the hospital, died, had direct breathing problems from the fire?
Oh, sure. Well, nobody has died specifically because of the fire.
Specifically, right.
I mean, Todd Dombrowski went to the hospital, you know, to be checked out after that. John Coddington, you know, certainly did. He was unconscious in the ambulance on the way there.
Right.
And there have been other, well, there, you know, as far as people getting sick from the gases, any number of children who lived in the mine fire impact area in the early 1980s, you know, became ill. You had parents who, you know, like Dave Lamb, who would take his daughter who had asthma and just take her, you know, for rides away from the house, you know, so she could breathe clean air. And they finally brought in an oxygen bottle, you know, for her, and that helped. But there were other kids. You know, Shannon Buckley was affected by the gases, and she, you know, her parents, you know, did everything they could. You know, you will hear from some of the diehards that, you know, there was never any real, you know, danger from the gases. Well, that's just
No, not at all. I just don't understand, especially when it's affecting a child, how you could stay there at all.
Well, it wasn't, I mean, these were, you know, hardworking, you know, people. You know, they were lower middle class for the most part, and, you know, good people, you know, hardworking people. And they owned their houses, but there was no way. I mean, they just did not have the wherewithal to walk away from that house into, you know, some unknown situation. So they kind of, you know, they try to find ways to deal with the situation, you know, like taking their kids on these car rides to get them away from the house, you know, but it was a bad situation, and that was why relocation was necessary, you know, to give people the means of leaving this really bad environmental hazard, and not to be, you know, wiped out by the experience.
Later on, there were still diehards of diehards. I believe this was the late 80s. There was actually a murder-suicide that pretty much was over this argument of whether to stay or go. They were facing eviction, the couple that was involved. How did that murder-suicide affect the people that were still there at that time?
Well, people were, obviously they were devastated by it, you know, because this is a small town. Everybody knew each other. And, you know, as far as anybody could tell, you know, the murder-suicide was directly related to, you know, the husband and wife, you know, fighting over whether to relocate. You know, he wanted to relocate. She didn't. Part of the problem, you know, you get these kind of technicalities in Centralia. They rented their house. And so they didn't have the option to just say, we're staying. The person that owned the house, you know, decided to sell, and they were not allowed to move elsewhere in Centralia. And so it just got worse and worse between them, and, you know, one day he killed her and then drove out in the strippings not that far from where Jane Benfield died, and set himself on fire.
I have read that in 2016 it's expected many, many former residents will be coming back to open up the time capsule that was buried in, I believe it was 66.
Yes.
I know this is a little far ahead. God willing, we're all around. Is this something, because you've been involved with this for so long, that you're looking forward to?
I guess I am. I'm not like, you know, terribly excited about it. I mean, I these time capsule stories tend not to be, you know, they're more exciting in the anticipation than they are in the opening. if I'm around and I may go up there and check it out. I'm sure there'll be some kind of news coverage of it too. You know, again, in 2016, you know, the people that really, really care about that time capsule, well, there'll be some of them left, but, you know, they're getting fewer and far between.
John Lakitas, what was your impression after viewing the film? Do you think that film was kind of trying to give him a view of someone who was a little bit out of touch with what was going on around him, or I mean, what's your impression of the town that was the film and your impression of John Lukitas?
I thought the film did a really good job of telling the Centralia story. I particularly liked the fact that Chris Burkle and Georgie Rowland, the directors, were able to find Super 8 film footage that had been shot in Centralia in the early 1960s, and to kind of give a picture of what the town was, before the mine fire became the all-encompassing thing, that it was. And they talked to the right people. They talked to all sorts of people. But yes, John Lukitas was the centerpiece, the central character, of this story. And I think why they were attracted to his story was because it didn't seem to be, I don't want to say not rational, but it's not the kind of thing that a lot of people would do. I mean, to live there by yourself, on a street with no neighbors, and or at least later in the story there were no neighbors, and then try, through a variety of means to keep alive, the things that used to happen in Centralia, like putting up the Christmas lights and that sort of thing, mowing the lawns, and all that. John was very dedicated to, trying to save Centralia. And it was not something that he was ever going to win. In fact, ultimately, the Rendell administration, required him to leave. But his house is gone now. You look at his family, and it's interesting because the various Lukitases, in Centralia were not of one mind about the mine fire. John and his parents and his grandparents were very much, in the let's not relocate, state of things. But there were other relatives who lived right in the impact zone, and they ended up relocating, because they had problems with gases in their house. And so it just kind of, his family story kind of goes to show, the tensions, the emotions that existed, because of this mine fire.
The story of Tom Larkin, who was probably one of the most vocal of the defenders of Centralia, trying to get the relocation going.
Right.
And he recently passed away as well.
Sorry to say, yeah.
He was a dear friend of yours. I know you went to his wake in Philadelphia. How important was a figure like Tom Larkin, number one, and number two, just a little bit about the friendship that you guys had over the years?
Well, I actually met Tom when I was sent to Centralia. I think it was early in 1981. It was after Todd Dombosky, but before John Connington. And I was sent to do a man-on-the-street interview, as we called them at the time, and in the newspaper world. You just go out and you find people out on the street, victims you can grab and ask a question and take their picture. And so he would he was one of the people that I ran into. I wouldn't say we became friends immediately, but we did pretty much soon thereafter, and when he became the president of the Concerned Citizens Organization, he was president, Joan Girolami was vice president, and they were both, very effective people in their own way, in fighting for, help for the town that they loved. And Tom was, Tom's, roots in Centralia went very deep, back into the, well into the 19th century. And he had, at one point, he had trained to be a Roman Catholic priest. He ultimately did not become ordained. But there was always that, kind of the Irish Catholic priest in him. Even though he wasn't a priest, he got the sense that he really was, And so he was very good with people. He was very, very gentle, but he could, show an Irish temper, too. He was very, very effective at talking, to outsiders. He seemed very reasonable, very calm, very intelligent. You know, he was on Good Morning America, you know, with Todd Nabosky, you know, in the summer of 1981. And so, you know, he was, you know, a good guy, and he got a lot of grief from the other side, you know, for his activities. And ultimately he resigned as president of Concerned Citizens, you know, because of that. But, you know, what he did, you know, really helped in the end toward getting a resolution to the problem.
It's just one of those things that, you know, you're not attached to directly, but when you read about it, you watch documentaries, read books about it, you can't help but feel helpless, like you want to do something. At the same time, just get out. I mean, there's no way this is going to turn out any better.
Yeah. I think it's just human nature. You know, you especially when our homes are involved, we tend not to want to cut and run. You know, we want to deal with the problem and fix the problem. Even though, like in Centralia's case, it was, you know, increasingly difficult to believe that the problem would ever be solved in a good way. You know, look at my own situation. I live in a flood zone, you know, down here in Harrisburg, and it's a beautiful historic neighborhood called Shipoke. And since we've lived here, the 23 years we've lived here, we've been flooded out 3 times. Is that rational behavior? I don't know, but we love this neighborhood.
Now, David, I do have a caller. Are you willing to take a question?
Sure.
Caller, state your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Tom, and I'm from Princeton, New Jersey. Hi, David. How are you?
Hi, good.
Good. I'm one of those people who had never been to Centralia until last year when I took a visit. I'd become involved in the story by reading your book and the books of others and seeing the documentary that was very well done. I had a quick two-part question for you. After seeing the area and the surrounding area last summer, I was in Shamokin for a while. The first part of my question is, do you feel that a lot of the feelings that people like John Mokaitis had about Centralia may have been complete, simple nostalgia, because Shamokin is a pretty depressed place. There's a lot of unemployment. I know in the post-coal era and after the Depression, you know, a lot of those people are unemployed or had to go to Harrisburg for work, and I wonder if a lot of their feelings about the town maybe overstated what a great little place it might have been. And the second question is, what did this current administration have to gain by really kicking a guy like Mokaitis out of there, who was out of the imminent danger zone and all that kind of thing? Have you really caused them any harm other than really not paying any taxes and living kind of
squatter?
Yeah, as a squatter. I mean, what did they really have to gain by kicking the guy out and back and, you know, backfilling his house? And I thank you for your answer in advance.
Yeah, as far as, you know, whether the niceness of Centralia was overstated, I mean, everything's in the eye of the beholder. I mean, to them it was nice. You know, to somebody else it may not have been very nice. You know, but I think, you know, the quality of life there is reflected now by the fact that the town lives on online. You know, there's Facebook pages dedicated to Centralia. You know, there's a Yahoo News group. And, you know, and they all attract slightly different, you know, groups of people. Like one of the pages on Facebook attracts a lot of young adults who were, you know, teenagers at the time in the early 80s when all the mine fire troubles were going on. And now they're kind of nostalgic and curious about the town where they, you know, they lived for the first, you know, 18 to 20 years of their lives. You know, so who are we to say, you know, whether they're correct in that their town was nice? I mean, to them it was nice. Now, as far as, you know, John Mokaitis, it wasn't the current administration. We now have Governor Tom Corbett, a Republican in Harrisburg. It was the previous governor, Ed Rendell, a Democrat, who, you know, invoked eminent domain or followed through on eminent domain, you know, with John Mokaitis. You know, so whether he should have been allowed to live there, you know, I don't know. He lived right on the edge of the impact zone. In theory, you know, the fire, you know, probably eventually would have moved closer to where he lived. Whether he still would have been alive then, I don't know. But, you know, it's, I think it was really kind of the bureaucratic imperative took over, and they just said, well, we started this process, we got to finish it. And so they made a move.
And Carl Wilmer is still there, is that correct?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. Well, thanks very much, David. I appreciate your answers and your time.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thank you, sir, for calling in. We appreciate you listening in.
You have another book that's published. It started out you were researching Three Mile Island, and it became a story about the epidemic.
Well, there was this company by the name of General Public Utilities Corporation that was responsible for the Three Mile Island nuclear accident in south of Harrisburg in 1979. And I wasn't living in Harrisburg at the time. I was still living up in Shamokin. But, you know, after I moved down to Harrisburg and started working for the Patriot News there, in 1989, 10 years after the accident, I led a team of reporters who did a series of articles looking back on, you know, the accident, which was a huge event in the Harrisburg area. 100,000 people fled the community. But anyway, in my part of that work was to write a recreation of the accident. And so I did that, and I became fascinated by the story. And I eventually discovered that the GPU had a former existence as a company called Associated Gas and Electric. And Associated Gas and Electric had gone bankrupt in 1940 and had come out of bankruptcy in 1946 as General Public Utilities. But what I found fascinating was that, you know, it was an extremely corrupt company. I mean, their leader, whose name was Howard Hobson, was just a classic white-collar criminal, you know, ripped off you know, his shareholders, his ratepayers, you know, you name it, and all the while building Associated Gas and Electric into this gigantic utility holding company that had companies in 26 states and two foreign countries. And in the process of doing that, I discovered that the history went back even further to 1903, when the very earliest predecessors of that company were responsible for a typhoid epidemic in Ithaca, New York, the home of Cornell University. And this story was just incredible. I mean, you know, you had a guy who comes in, he buys the local you know, gas and water companies, a guy by the name of William Morris, pays too much for them, is helped by Cornell University to finance the deal because some of their trustees will benefit from, you know, the sale. And so he spends too much money, and he builds this dam because he wants to sell more water. And in the process of building the dam, he brings in foreign immigrant workers from Italy. And I have nothing against, you know, him doing that, but the problem was that, you know, at least one of them was a typhoid carrier, and Morris didn't enforce sanitation, you know, at the work site. And so eventually the town's water supply became contaminated, you know, with typhoid germs, and it became one of the worst typhoid epidemics, in percentage terms at least, in American history, especially in the later history of typhoid. And it became a story, in some ways, like Centralia, of a small town struggling to save itself, you know, and people, you know, trying to do whatever they had to do to get past this disaster. And so I spent a number of years researching that, and in 2011 it was published by Globe Pequot Press by Lions Press, which is an imprint of Globe Pequot. It was published as The Epidemic, and that's the story on that.
And you're also working right now on another book. It will be published in 2013, I believe?
That's correct. It's called The Girl Who Was Killed in the Library, and it's about the Betsy Arzma murder at Penn State in 1969. She was stabbed to death in Petit Library, the main library on the Penn State campus, and the killer fled into the night, never caught. It was through a series of mishaps at the start of the investigation, and just incredible bad luck. You know, it was never solved. You know, the state police now know who it was. They're never going to officially, you know, solve, quote-unquote, the case because the guy's dead. But my book covers the whole, you know, story of this, you know, kind of like the, you know, the book Helter Skelter covered the Manson family murders. And the what got me interested in this was that Betsy Arzma, the girl who was killed, was from my hometown in Holland, Michigan. And she went to my high school. I didn't know her because she was 6 years older than me. But, you know, I remember very well when her murder was on page one of the Holland Evening Sentinel. And so that always kind of stayed with me. And you know, as I was preparing to leave the Patriot News in 2008 as part of a buyout, the last story that I did was kind of an update on where the investigation stood. And after that, I decided I would write a book on it, and that's what I'm working on now.
The lasting legacy of Centralia, why, after 50 years now, people still care about it?
Well, there's a number of reasons. You know, it's a weird story. I mean, you know, frankly, and that keeps people interested, you know, too. You know, it's the idea of a fire burning underneath, you know, underneath people's houses, underneath a town. I mean, that's what initially interested me in the story when I heard Tony Gaughan, you know, talk about the fire burning underground near his house. It was just, you know, an incredible thing to hear. And so there's people who stay interested in the story, you know, for that reason. You know, and then it's just a great human interest story, again, of people struggling to save themselves and their community and ultimately losing that fight, you know, and having to leave the town that they loved. As far as what, you know, Centralia, you know, what the greater meaning of it is, I mean, I think really it goes to show that, you know, when you're extracting energy, you know, from the ground, you have to be careful of the environment. I mean, that wasn't done, you know, in any of the coal mine that was done in Pennsylvania, you know, beginning in the mid-19th century and continuing, you know, on up to the mid-20th century. It wasn't until that law that was passed, really, you know, by, you know, President Jimmy Carter and the Congress that mining truly came under control as far as having to clean it up right away and not just, you know, walk away and maybe somebody will come back and fill in the hole, you know, 50 years later. Now you have to do it the right way. But there's still, I mean, as you drive through, you know, northeastern Pennsylvania and the Centralia area and the Shamokin area, I mean, you see evidence everywhere of that century of coal mining that went on, that century of unregulated coal mining. And it's particularly timely, I think, you know, in Pennsylvania, you know, because we're kind of at, you know, the center of the Marcellus Shale gas boom. You know, and already there's environmental problems with that. You know, it's hard to decide which way to come down on the shale gas issue because those new supplies of gas have lowered everybody's gas prices. I mean, my gas bill this winter was a lot lower than it's been in a long time, and that shale gas is the reason because, you know, supply and demand. Mm-hmm. But you don't want people to have, you know, flaming tap water, you know, in their houses. You know, you don't want their water to be, you know, contaminated with drilling chemicals. You know, so there has to be, you know, very strict regulation of this resource, the extraction of this resource, so that we don't end up, you know, with another 100 years of environmental damage like we had with coal.
I don't know, flaming tap water sounds fun.
Not much you can do with it, though, except to, you know, impress your friends. But
yeah, look at this, guys.
Yeah.
If people want to find out more about you, is there a place that they can get in touch with you?
My website is www.daviddcook.com. That has things about, you know, all three of my books there on it. And you'll find some things on there about the history of Centralia and you know, how I got involved in the story, you know, and that sort of thing. I have a Centralia news page that I try to keep up to date, you know, with things happening, you know, in the Centralia story. You know, and then, of course, there's my book, Fire Underground, which you can get at, you know, from the online bookstores, from Amazon, from Barnes & Noble. It's available on Kindle and Nook, you know, as an e-book. And Barnes & Noble actual bookstores, at least in the Northeast, will often have a copy of it. You know, can't promise for sure, but, you know, a lot of they've been pretty good about selling the book. Those are really the places I would suggest you turn.
David, this was a great interview.
Pleasure.
I want to thank you for your time. And I'd like to do it again in the future. Maybe we can get a little bit more into the Centralia story. I know we covered a lot of it, but there's still parts that we glazed over a little bit. And a little bit more into the epidemic as well, because that's the book that's out there right now that people can also pick up. But I do really want to thank you, and it was a pleasure, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Okay. And you have a great night now.
Okay, good night.
Okay. And that was David DeCook.
It's really awesome.
You can also find him on Twitter at David DeCook. Just spell out the name. It's David and then DeKook. So, guys, a little bit about the Centralia story. What do you think after all that information?
I mean, after watching the movie, you know, the documentary that was mentioned, and reading up on, well, I mean, I've read it up on it in the past. Finding out that we were going to talk about this, just my interest, was piqued again, and I just can't help, as I stated to David, just feeling like helpless, like knowing that you can't do anything. There is fire burning underneath you as you stand, and we're going to stay here, and we're going to stay here till the end. It just blows my mind. And again, I'm not in that situation, but I'd like to think if my home, something that I cherished as much as my home, if I was in danger of losing it, I would fight that hard to keep it, as hard as these people have fought to keep it.
I rent where I live. It has a leaky roof. It has this, that, the other, whatever.
It's home.
The thing is, I think a lot of the people, too, it was a depressed area, even in the 60s when all this started. So I think it was a lot harder. People go, why would you live there? I think some people, it was really a matter of, at least initially, before the government stepped in and said, we'll buy you out. I think it was initially that they just really didn't have a means to get out of there. And that's just my opinion. I don't know. But, of course, there were generations of families that lived there. It was a mining community. People literally coming right over and starting a life in Centralia as a miner. And the families just stayed there. Like, the Larkins were there for years. I think he said in the documentary that there were seven generations of his family there that were buried where his ashes were actually interned. Tom Larkin's ashes were actually taken back up to Centralia, and that's where they meet final rest. So,
I mean, it's just like this. I mean, I moved from my home in October to a new home where I live now, and just moving. There was nothing going on. It was just I moved to be with my girlfriend full-time and to start a life outside of, you know, the home I grew up in, and that kills me that I'm not at home anymore. I mean, my family has been in that area since they came over on the boat, and I'm the first one that has left that area.
So then you can kind of understand that story.
Yeah,
that
all I want to do is go home.
So you can understand the ties that these miners and this is. It's almost the same exact story, what you're saying, that these miners were talking about, too. Mark?
Really appreciative of his time, and just glad we had him on.
Great interview. I will definitely talk with him in the future. The epidemic, I'm very interested to get into. It's a very interesting story. When he was talking about it, I believe it came out last year sometime, he was talking about it on his Facebook, and it intrigued me. It was another story about a small town, like he was saying. It's similar to Centralia in some ways, as far as small town and how it affected a community. And just the way he wrote Fire Underground, and now I have to see it, and I'd love to get him back on. And especially when the Penn State story, when that gets published, I'd love to have him back on. So, great interview, great night. So, guys, any final words?
I just wanted to thank, I had a bunch of listeners, I had a bunch of people listening on this. I want to thank them for tuning in and giving us input.
You can follow me at Folsom County on Twitter. You can follow Dan at DanLaw83. And you can follow Mark at Go Thompson on Twitter. We are on iTunes. Just search for Hell in a Cell Talk Radio. Subscribe. Leave a review. We also have a fan page. There's plenty of stuff. Go to the blog. That's actually a good place to start because you can find the links for everything at the blog. And that is hellinacell.wordpress.com. Again, that's hellinacell.wordpress.com. Go there. Check it out. I have written about shows I've seen, and I keep an updated listing of the guests and everything we have planned. For the above-average comedian, Dan Law.
Woohoo!
For Go Thompson, and for myself, Double D. Thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back on Wednesday.